Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Elliot Gerson of the Aspen Institute, and it is our great pleasure and privilege to host all of you this afternoon for what we are confident will be an extraordinary afternoon of conversation and discovery. First, I would like to welcome all of our pass holders for the second session of the Aspen Ideas Festival. This is the formal beginning of your time at the festival, and we're delighted you're here. This is our transition day, our overlap day, and sadly, it is also the time that I have to say goodbye and thank you very much to those of you who are with us the first session, and we look forward to seeing as many of you back here next year as possible. And also, and very importantly, I'd like to welcome our friends and neighbors in the Roaring Fork Valley who are here today for this session. And this session, as well as the many sessions we've had every evening this week, are designed to make available some of the passion and excitement that has animated our campus all this week to all of you who live here in the community. And we're thrilled to have you with us as well. It is now my pleasure to launch this conversation this afternoon with two absolutely remarkable guests. The Honorable Stephen G. Breyer was nominated by President Clinton to the Supreme Court in 1994. He took the seat that had been filled by Justice Blackmun, a judge who, incidentally, as we heard over the course of this week, spent a great deal of time here at the Aspen Institute, and time that was extremely influential in shaping his own judicial philosophy. Justice Breyer was born in San Francisco, attended Stanford, Oxford as a Marshall Scholar, and then Harvard Law School. He clerked for Justice Goldberg, worked as a lawyer in private and public practice, including a stint as chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He taught at Harvard, and he served as Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit before his elevation to the Supreme Court. The Honorable Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Reagan in 1981 to take the seat vacated by Potter Stewart. She was born in El Paso, raised on a ranch in Arizona, and attended Stanford both for college and for law school. After finishing near the very top of her class at Stanford Law School, no law firm in California offered her a position. Although I think you were offered a position or an interview. Although, didn't they offer you a position as a legal secretary?
Well, I finally got one firm through an undergraduate friend of mine whose father was in the firm to give me an interview. And after we chatted for a while, he said, "Well, Miss Day, how do you type?" And I said, "Well, fair." And he said, "Well, if you can type well enough, we might be able to get you a job here as a legal secretary." I didn't pursue it.
Well, of course, at that time, it was almost inconceivable that there would be a woman on the Supreme Court. So Justice O'Connor turned to public service very early in her career. She returned to Arizona. She became a lawyer for the state, a Republican state senator, and then a Senate Majority Leader, and I think she was actually the first female Senate Majority Leader in any state in the country. She was then elected to a Superior Court judgeship and then was appointed to the Arizona Court of Appeals by the governor.
By Governor Bruce Babbitt, who's a participant here
yes.
today.
And as a matter of fact, I don't know if Governor Babbitt is actually here, but I think sort of in the spirit of Aspen Institute bipartisanship, I think we need to all thank him for reaching across the aisle and in that way contributing to the development of one of the most important and influential American leaders of really the last century, and just incidentally, the first woman who has had the privilege of sitting on the Supreme Court. I will start the conversation with each justice and then open things up to the audience, and when we do that, we have microphones on either aisle in front, and when you do have questions, I ask you to keep them short and direct and to end the questions with a question mark.
Do we have to answer briefly and directly?
No, you need not. And you can also express dissenting and concurring opinions. Justice Breyer, the Supreme Court just finished its term. We're delighted it did, or you wouldn't be here with us today. And as always, it seems that we Americans learn more about the court in that last week, because so many of the important decisions wait till the end of the term to be announced, and a disproportionate amount of what we read about the court is written at that time. One of those cases, which has received perhaps disproportionate comment, of course, is Hamdan against Rumsfeld. And it involved, as I think everyone in this tent know, presidential powers, Guantanamo Bay, the Geneva Convention, and military tribunals. You were in the majority that reversed the Court of Appeals, and you rejected the president's very strong assertions and the passionate arguments of the dissenters that such a ruling would sorely hamper this nation's ability to confront and defeat a new and deadly enemy and prevent further September 11th. Those kinds of arguments, especially coming from the president in a time of war, must have been very difficult to resist, yet you did. And you also wrote a very short concurrence, perhaps to inspire those of you who will be asking questions, very direct and concise, and I'm going to quote it. Whereas here, no emergency prevents consultation with Congress, judicial insistence upon that consultation does not weaken our nation's ability to deal with danger. To the contrary, that insistence strengthens the nation's ability to determine, through democratic means, how best to do so. The Constitution places its faith in those democratic means. Our court today simply does the same. Was this a hard conclusion to reach? And can you tell us what you meant in that concurrence?
Well, if it doesn't say what I meant, I'm unlikely to be able to help. Was it a difficult conclusion to reach? No, that conclusion was not difficult. Once it seemed conceded that in this instance, consultation with Congress was not forbidden by some immediate necessity.
Do you think the commentators who have questioned over the days since whether this is a very broad and sweeping decision of tremendous significance, along with perhaps the Youngstown Steel case and the most important cases on presidential power, or is it a case about 12 men in Guantanamo?
I think that the job, and I think that Justice O'Connor will verify this, is a job in which you have a case and you decide it as best you can. And like so many things, I suspect I see Senator Simpson, I bet that's true in all the branches of government. What history will say or some other people will say about that decision is somewhat unknown, and it's really up to them. I'm not saying we didn't think this was an important case. Of course it was an important case. But what it means precisely for the future is something that one really can't know until the future develops. So my job is to write the opinion as best I can. And it is the job of the commentators to comment, which I never resent, as long as I don't read it.
Justice O'Connor, you of course retired from the court and did not participate. And you needn't tell us whether you agree or not, although you're free to, of course. But I would like you to comment on the difficulty, whether in that case or other cases you might want to talk about, that judges sometimes have ruling in a way that they strongly believe is right, but might be politically unpopular. And that is the importance of the principle of judicial independence. Indeed, it only took a matter of hours after that opinion was announced that critics of the court in the media and even some in Congress condemned the court in very strong language and even worse. You've been very outspoken since your retirement about the importance of judicial independence, and you've also written that you think it is growing and that it is an ominous trend. Could you comment on that?
The criticism is growing, yes. I've lived a long time now, and in my lifetime, I have never seen such virulent criticism of judges as I have seen in the last few years. And we have seen proposals both in Congress and in state legislatures that are very surprising in terms of proposing specific action in retaliation against judges who make a decision with whom the legislator, a decision which the legislator doesn't like and thinks requires something, such as impeachment of any federal judge who might cite an opinion of a foreign court, or the appointment of inspectors general for judges to make sure they didn't make a trip to Aspen that was paid for by somebody, and provisions to cut the budgets of federal courts in retaliation for certain decisions. I mean, proposals to strip federal courts of jurisdiction over certain classes of cases. Now, this is a remarkable series of happenings. We have a proposal in South Dakota, you may have read about, to change the constitution in that state to remove judicial immunity for actions by judges, jurors, and witnesses in cases, and to allow disgruntled litigants to then sue the judges, jurors, and witnesses, and even put them in jail if need be. It's called Jail for Judges. Now, this is the climate in which we're living today, and I worry about that. I hear clapping for Jail for Judges. Well, maybe so, but my concern is that the framers of our Constitution thought it was of critical, critical importance in establishing three branches of government that we have an independent judiciary, at least at the federal level, and all the states copied that model. Their thought was that without that, the provisions of the Constitution that were so precious to our citizens couldn't be enforced. And look back in history. For instance, the decision of the Supreme Court in the 1950s, which was unanimous at the time, to strike down segregated public schools, schools segregated on the basis of race. That was a very unpopular decision in many parts of this country. If judges had consulted public opinion, they could not have found that resolution, and we would still be operating with segregated schools. And yet today, I think all citizens of this country agree that we mustn't discriminate on the basis of race in providing public services and benefits. So this is just one of many examples where judicial action was required, and it might not have been popular at the time, but which over time becomes clear was a courageous and correct thing for judges to have done.
Let me ask you. Thank you. Let me ask you further on the importance of judicial independence from political pressure. Your judicial career began, I believe, when you ran for office. I'm sorry. Let me ask a further question about the importance of political independence from judicial independence from political pressure. I believe you began your judicial career running for a judgeship, running for partisan election as a judge. Do you think that practice is a good practice in the United States?
No. I come from Arizona, and Arizona was a state that believed very strongly in populism and in the ability to recall judges and other political officers and to elect judges in partisan elections. When I was in the Arizona State Senate, I had seen at close range the result of partisan election of judges, and I didn't like the results. Some judges were pretty good and others were pretty bad, and I thought we could do better if we had a merit selection system, such as that originally conceived by the state of Missouri, where state judges were appointed initially by the governor based on recommendations by a bipartisan citizens committee, and then the judge would run for retention after a period of years, and the voters could get rid of the judge if they didn't like the judge, but otherwise would reaffirm for a new term. Now, I lived in Arizona long enough to see the benefits of that change, and I was able to get it passed in Arizona, made the proposal, and it was put to the people in the form of a constitutional amendment, which passed very narrowly in the same election in which I ran for and was elected for judge. And I've seen the benefits in Arizona of that system. Now, that system is followed in only a minority of states in the United States, I regret to say, and in some of those states today, there are legislative efforts to abolish it. And that's part and parcel of this problem that I'm talking about.
Thank you. Justice Breyer, in your book, Act of Liberty, and I'm going to pitch both of these books, by the way. The Constitution, as you all know, says that judicial salaries cannot be lowered while they're in office, but it also says nothing about increasing their salaries, which are much too low. So please do buy both of these books.
I don't think either of us get any profits from it, so don't do it for that reason, okay?
Well, it might be a good reason.
Justice Breyer, in your book, Act of Liberty, which was based on lectures that you gave just 2 years ago, you forcefully argue that the court should embrace an expansive concept of liberty, that liberty means something beyond protecting the minority against the tyranny of the majority, and that in fact there's something fundamental to our democracy about the active participation of citizens in government. Can you talk to us a little bit about that central animating thesis in your book, and perhaps give us some practical examples of active liberty?
Well, I think the challenge was put to me by Sandra. I had to give these lectures to my former colleagues at Harvard, and that's a difficult group. You know, you have to have something there to say. And she said once, which is true, as you first become a member of the court, you begin to decide things, and if the truth of the matter be known, I'm not certain how I'm going to decide things. I don't go to the court with an agenda, and I don't think anybody does. But time will tell how we decide the cases as they come up. And the metaphor she used, which is true, is in those earlier years, you have footsteps. You create footsteps. They become firmer and firmer, and it becomes harder and harder to deviate from what you've done in the past in terms of principle. So after a few years, I thought I'd try to sit back and look and see if my decisions did form a kind of pattern, and if so, what? Well, that's background. And I wanted to say that we see, and I think most of us see, the Constitution after a while. In terms of a whole, that's a rare privilege in our job. A lower court judge works with bits of it. But we have a pretty broad view of it because most of it comes in front of us at one time or another. And if you ask any of us, well, what is it about? It sounds a little bit like a 4th of July speech. I'll say, well, what does it do? And again, we were sitting with Tony Kennedy, and we were at a conference, and Vartan Gregorian was saying, well, what's the most important thing to teach to the students of the United States about the Constitution? And we'd gotten some Bar Association replies. They said free speech or privacy or religion. We all had the same reaction. That's not what it's about. Those things are important, but that's not what it's about. What is it about? We all said democracy. That's what it's about. It's about creating institutions that do not permit judges or anyone else to decide what to do, but that permit citizens to decide what kinds of rules they want to govern their community. Now, it's a certain kind of democracy. It's a democracy that protects basic individual rights. It's a democracy that separates power among state, federal, and three branches of government, so no one becomes too powerful. It's a democracy that insists upon a certain degree of equality, and it's a democracy that insists upon a rule of law. All right? Wouldn't everyone agree to that? And once you're there, you say, well, that's a 4th of July speech. And I want to say, no, it isn't. Oddly enough, it isn't. Because if you're there working with the document over time, you discover one practical thing and one purely legal thing. That those basic 4th of July principles do, in fact, help you decide concrete cases. They have a real role. And in particular, the one that I don't want forgotten and why I wrote this is that first word, democracy. We hear a lot about free speech. We don't hear that much about that word where it means something. It means that people go out and participate themselves. So the theme of the book is we don't need activist judges. You do need activist citizens. You need activist citizens because the activist citizens have to create the kinds of communities that they want by themselves without help, certainly without help from us. And if they don't, we say that Constitution won't work. That I'm pretty sure is true. What are we doing up there? Well, I guess what we're doing, and it's hard enough, is we're trying to keep the democracy on the rails that the Constitution set. I mean, you can't go too far this way, you can't go too far that way, because there are protections of free speech, and there are institutional protections, and there is a division of power, and we get into terrible arguments about some of those meaning exactly of what rail. But we're still just there at the boundaries. And it's right in between those boundaries that the meat and bread and butter and potatoes or whatever you like of that Constitution takes place. And that's the job of the citizen to participate. All right, that's a long speech,
but
that's what
one.
I'm trying to get across in that book.
But, Justice Breyer, given the centrality in your view about active, passionate even, participation in government, we've been talking over the last few days about a number of things, including declining electoral participation in this country, evidence of declining trust in the government, declining knowledge even about the basic principles of our government. Are there things you think that judges can do about that problem?
First thing for judges to do is to do their job. I learned that from a judge a long time ago who said, I don't want to be too, look, a judge is a person who is given by political authority and the Constitution a degree of power to affect the lives of other people. And in that narrow area, and it is narrow, in that narrow area, people will listen to you because you have authority. You try to go beyond that area and start to tell them what they ought to do in a lot of other areas, people will listen politely. That's because they think maybe sometime they'll be in front of you. But they're thinking something else. Goodbye. See you around. I have a lot to do today. Thank you for the help. Okay. But that, so it's dangerous. Now, I would say, though, on your topic, there is something on that particular topic. And I just wish some of the people who are the most skeptical could come into our courtroom for a couple of days. It's a good experience. Why? Because we see in front of us people of every race, every religion, every point of view, and believe me, 300 million people, there are 900 million points of view. And those people, so different, who really are angry at each other, really angry, they've decided to resolve so many of those disputes under law. Now, that was true last year. It was true when we decided Bush v. Gore. Think of how many people disagree with that one. Well, were they on the streets with sticks and stones? I didn't see them. Think of how many people disagree with us about abortion. Think of how many people disagree with us about prayer in schools. By the way, are we right on those things? I don't know. I know you have judges doing their best on it. That doesn't mean they're all right. They can't be right. Some go one way, some go another. They can't all be right. Regardless, despite the strength of feeling, people do follow it. That wasn't always true. Justice O'Connor gave you a few examples. Go back another 100 years. Remember Dwight Eisenhower sending the 101st Airborne to Little Rock. It wasn't 9 judges who had to enforce those opinions. It was the paratroopers. Remember Andrew Jackson, who said John Marshall made his decision? Let him enforce it. And he sent paratroopers, he sent some militia to evict the Indians. The court had said this land belongs to the Indians. He sent the troops, all right. They evicted him and sent him to Oklahoma. Now, that isn't true today. And so I'd say there's a lot of improvement there, a lot of improvement. And when I hear all these arguments, I'm probably the only one in the country, maybe she does, agrees with me too, but when I hear all the Patriot Act, the country's going down the drain, oh my God, this right to privacy thing, what a disaster, terrible, this is the worst bill I've ever seen. I hear all that and I say, hey, that's not so bad. Why not so bad? Because I had to read for some other speech I gave. I had to read some things about Tocqueville. And Tocqueville says, in 1840, the first thing I noticed in the United States of America is the clamor. And by that, he means everybody screaming at each other. And they did scream at each other. About what? He says, politics. That's what. They disagree. And so we have a system. You don't like that Patriot Act? Scream. I mean, let's try to be civil. But then maybe there'll be some changes. Maybe a few experiments. Maybe we go this way, that way. At the very end of the day, the courts come in. But that is, it seems to me, the democratic process at work. Not perfectly by any means. I don't applaud every bit of it by any means. But when you consider the alternatives, as we all know, it looks as if there is an awful lot of involvement in the United States. And I think she and I would be the first ones out there to say, and we'd like even more.
Thank you. Justice O'Connor, when you retired from the court, you didn't retire to your ranch. You have been active in countless issues, and not just in this country, but also abroad. We've been talking about the independence of the judiciary. You have also spent a good bit of time, and I'd like you to share with the audience why you think independence of the judiciary and the rule of law is so important internationally as well.
The phrase rule of law was first proposed by a former American Bar Association president back in the early 1950s. And the concept was that under a rule of law, people through the democratic process have a hand in promoting and eventually through their elected representatives having laws enacted. And there are independent judges who can enforce those laws. And in that way, we manage to peacefully resolve disputes within our country. People, he mentioned Bush Gore, and people didn't take to the streets. It was handled through court proceedings enforcing our electoral college system, under which it is possible for the popular vote to go one way and the end result another. And that was what people found surprising. When it happens, it does seem surprising, but that's the system adopted by the framers. Anyway, the Soviet Union broke apart, 15, 17 years ago now, and that left an enormous part of the world cut off from the Soviet Union. They wanted to form their own nation states. And 26 separate nation states formed out of the territory that broke off from the Soviet Union. And they wanted to set up some kind of governmental structure. And American lawyers and judges, as volunteers, agreed to provide some technical assistance to help them write constitutions, write laws, and very importantly, set up independent judicial systems to make those independent nations' structures work in a free market environment. That has been enormously successful. Not in every single one of those nations, but in most of them, many of which are now members of the European Union. They've progressed that far with their new systems of governance. And it's been a remarkable thing. One of the things that those nation states most admired from us was our judicial system. They liked the federal judicial system they saw in this country and tried to emulate it. And the sad thing for me is to now see that under so much attack. Because rule of law if followed in other nations, is our best guarantee of peace in the future. So I'd like to see that continue.
Justice O'Connor, I guess it's your fate always to be the first woman on the Supreme Court. And you have been, in your non-belligerent sheer force of example and responsibility and influence, a powerful reminder of why women's participation as active citizens and leaders in all aspects of society is so important. Yet since you left, on two occasions you have seen the opportunity to appoint another woman to the court go past. How did you feel about that?
Sad. I had hoped that... I had hoped that when the time came that my seat would be filled by a qualified woman. And I know we have a very fine justice in office, and this is to take nothing from him or his qualifications. But I wish he was in a skirt. That's all there is to it. Anyway, that leaves one woman on the court, Justice Ginsburg, who is a very able justice. And she and I are often asked, and have often been asked, well, how does it make a difference for a woman to be on the court? That's hard to answer, because every justice comes to the court with his or her own life experiences, and we give to that process as well as we can. But both Justice Ginsburg and I tend to agree that at the end of the day, a wise old woman and a wise old man will reach the same conclusion. So I'm not sure that at the end of the day you see a women's decision and a man's decision. We hope it's a wise one in either case. But I would like to see not just two women on the court, but a good many more in years to come.
I'm going to ask just one more question, so if people will have questions, if you might line up at this time. Justice Breyer, another topic we've been discussing a great deal this week relates to religion and politics. And in your jurisprudence, you also write about considering consequences when you are looking at a particular constitutional issue, not just original intent, but consequences. You played a pivotal role in some important religion establishment clause recently, and perhaps you could give us as an example of this considering consequences, how it is that you came out on two different sides, in both cases I think in the majority, on the Ten Commandment cases, one in Kentucky and one in Texas. How did you do that, and how did you employ that particular test that you write about?
Through very careful consideration. The issue you want to get at is a little bit inside baseball, but I'll give you the philosophical issue. In my own mind, I tend to think that judges, whoever they are, appellate judges who are dealing with interpretation of law, have about the same ways of going about the problem. They read the text. They look at the history. What's the history of those words? They look at the tradition. What's the tradition of the use of those words? They look at precedent. They look at the purposes underlying the clause. What's the Fourth Amendment doing there? What's its purpose? Privacy of a certain kind. What's the First Amendment? Well, part of it's speech of a certain kind. The purpose, the basic purpose. And they look at the consequences. How will the consequences vary? Consequences, not any old consequence, but consequence looked at in terms of the purpose. You're not going to look at privacy consequences when I'm talking about free speech, but I'll look at speech consequences. All right, so those six things, text, history, tradition, precedent, purpose, consequence. That's what we're there with, basically. And those are the tools we use to answer difficult problems. Now, some judges try to emphasize the first four. They say what we really should look at is text, history, tradition, precedent, and stop there. Not always stop there, but most of the time stop there. And others, and I'm probably in that second group, say, well, we better look at the purposes and the consequences. They're very important in an awful lot of cases. And so I'm probably more in that second group. I'm not against looking at text, history, etc., but I do look at the purpose and consequence. All right. Ten Commandments case. That's what he wants me to talk about. He told me that in advance. Ten Commandments case, we have two examples, and they're fairly tough cases. You have one in Kentucky where they put a Ten Commandments display in a courthouse, and another one on the state fairgrounds in Tennessee, the Ten Commandments right up over there. And clause of the Constitution says, Congress shall make no law affecting the establishment of religion. The establishment of religion, that's a tough one. What's that about? Well, in my view, after, you know, doing as much research as I guess I could do, is that establishment clause there grows out of the 17th century, really, when the Protestants were murdering the Catholics and the Catholics were murdering the Protestants in England, and they just couldn't stop. And finally, they reached a truce. And the truce was, I'll practice my religion and teach it to my children, and you practice yours and teach it to your children. It was that mess there that led to freedom of religion, and then in our Constitution, an establishment clause. So I think, well, and I've said this, and people debate it sometimes, not everybody agrees, that that establishment clause has as one of its purposes trying to dampen down, to prevent the disputes people can get into in society, the fights they can get into because of religion. Because when you have a fight that's based on religion, it is not winnable because everyone is deciding on the basis of the most basic principle and they won't give in. So let's try to keep as few as possible, and I see that as a purpose. Okay, now we get to this case. Well, borderline cases. Has the government intervened too much in contravention of the Establishment Clause? Well, we have Kentucky. Now, there's some evidence there that the reason they put up that thing in Kentucky, the display, was they wanted to prove they could do it. Ha! That ha just emerged. I'm not saying ha. I mean, I don't know who said ha. But there might have been something. All right. Did you see the idea? The idea is we want to create maybe a little controversy here. There's a strong religious element to putting that thing in there. That's why they did it, to emphasize the religious nature, because the Ten Commandments are religious, but they could also be used for a secular purpose. Now let's look at Texas. Well, that's why I went that one way. Now we look at Texas. And in Texas, this monument, it is a monument, the Ten Commandments, there is no doubt. And the Ten Commandments are religious, but are they being used for a secular purpose primarily, or primarily a religious purpose? Well, I know how they got there. Where was it, by the way? It was on the state fairground, or the state capitol ground. Big grounds. They had 17 monuments. Indeed, if you count small ones, 21. What were they there for? It says that here's what they're to illustrate the ideals of the people of Texas. How many were religious? Just this one. How did this one get there? Well, it turns out it was Cecil B. DeMille who put it there. Cecil B. DeMille made this movie, and they found the actual memos where he wrote to his marketing people, go get the Eagles, which is a secular civic organization, to put Ten Commandments all over the country, and they'll go to my movie. All right, so that was part of it, and it had been there for 40 years, and nobody'd noticed it. All right, so there, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, hey, be very careful. What I'm doing now as a judge is I am recalling my own opinions. Now, a judge, like a human being, I don't make the distinction between those two, but a judge, as most human beings, go back, remember things in their own favor. So if there is a distinction between what I am now saying and what is written on paper, it is the paper that governs, and erase from your mind any of the things I'm saying. Now, with that qualification, you can begin to see why I thought this was primarily secular and more than that.
Because what I said was, if in fact we allow that Kentucky thing to remain, there are people going to go put these religious monuments all over the country. But if we take down this Texas one, there will be people going all over the country trying to chisel Ten Commandments off of public buildings because they're all over the place. And I thought both of those things would in fact stir up the religious animosity that underlies the very kinds of disputes, irresolvable disputes of strong feeling and principle, that Establishment Clause is there to stop. Now that was what underlay that view, and there are probably few other people in the country that agree with me, but nonetheless, thank you for the opportunity to explain it.
Let's go to questions. We only have about 10 minutes, so let's be quick with them, and thank you.
Keeping in mind that what you say today may not be what you wrote, upon reflection and looking back, do you have any second thoughts about what you wrote or felt in Bush v. Gore in 2000?
Well, are you asking both of us?
I sure am.
Okay, no, I'm happy to answer first and then you tackle it. The court handed down two different opinions in the case. The first one was unanimous because it was pretty clear Florida courts had not been applying federal law to a federal election in making their analysis. Now, the federal court never got around to making those changes before we got the second case. And then the court ended up with a decision saying that the ballots in several counties had been improperly handled. That's the hanging Chad business, remember, from Florida. And we did not send it back the second time by a 5-4 decision for Florida to go at it again. So the result became final, in effect, with the Bush prevailing over Mr. Gore in the final election. However, I think it's good to remember that there were three separate recounts of the votes in the disputed counties after that. And all three were supervised by members of the press, who, believe me, were anxious to find every possible error. They didn't find an error in any of the recounts, and the result at the end of the day would have been the same no matter what the Supreme Court opinion had said, because under the Electoral College system, Bush had more Electoral College votes than Gore, and therefore was elected, even though the popular vote nationwide went the other way. And so, no, I don't look back and think it would have changed anything. It didn't change anything. So the answer I give you is no. Now, my colleague disagrees.
Does he?
I actually don't disagree. I don't disagree. And I think, of course, every one of us on the court thought this was an unusual and a difficult decision. Stressful. I was in the dissent. And I know we all understood its importance, and we all understood its difficulty. And I can say on that, I think people did their best. And we can disagree about whether we should have taken it, whether we shouldn't have taken it, whether it should have come out one way or should have come out the other way. And I've talked at greater length on the subject elsewhere, and I think I won't talk at a great length now. But I want you to see out of that the psychology. The psychology, in my opinion, is this. We do have some difficult cases. We know well when a case is going to affect the entire country. I mean, I would say, if I wanted to say the most important I've been involved in, I think it's the affirmative action case. I think that had a big effect on the country, and at least would have if it had gone the other way. And I know there are a lot of people that disagree with that. All right, we face a lot of difficult decisions. People do their best, and then you move on, because there are more coming. And I got a good question on this at the University of Virginia. They said, were you disappointed? A student asked that. And he hesitated a lot to ask it. And I said, don't hesitate. The answer is obvious. Yes, I was disappointed. I said, I'm always disappointed when I'm in the minority. I said, moreover, what is it that I will do, as any of us do? Well, we'll wait till the next case. And I'll write another opinion, another dissent. And I'll say to Joanna, this time I've written it, and it's so good, it's going to convince them all. And she says, I've heard that one before. And so it might not. There are many issues. And the one thing is, the past is past. There's plenty to do. And we go on from there. Wouldn't you say psychology?
Yes, but in the presidential election case, you can be sure there will be another one in the future where it turns on Florida's vote. 100 years ago in Hayes-Tilden election, it was the same thing. Big dispute on the Florida vote. Who was going to be president? Well, whoever won Florida. And it also ended up being decided in an oddball way by members of the Supreme Court. So it looks like every 100 years the court's going to get one from Florida.
Thank you.
Next question.
Well, I want to thank Justice O'Connor for being such an incredible role model for so many of us. And I want to thank both of you. And I want to thank both of you for speaking about the relevance of foreign and international law in cases like the Michigan affirmative action cases, the juvenile death penalty cases, and other contexts. My question is about international law specifically. And when you've talked about the role of international law in interpreting the U.S. Constitution and U.S. law, oftentimes you've raised it for its ability to inform, as opposed to its binding quality or its decisive quality. So you've used it the way Aaron Barak, the outgoing president of the Israeli Supreme Court, says, as a good friend. But unlike the Israeli Supreme Court or the South African Constitutional Court or other high courts, it seems you've been reluctant to use international law for its binding quality. And after all, it is binding under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And I want to ask you if that's a strategic decision because Scalia and others say international law is undemocratic, or if there's something else going on there.
Well, you know, I think our Supreme Court, has in no instance cited a case from another jurisdiction as in any way binding on our interpretation of our own Constitution. I don't see the need for us to do so. In the cases where some foreign action has been cited, it has been in the sense of, well, this is interesting, isn't it? Just like you might refer to a law review article or to somebody's published opinion on something and say, well, now that's a good argument. Let's refer to that. But not as binding precedent. I see no need to do so in the future, but I don't think it's harmful to note what other nations have done by way of comparison. In the juvenile death penalty case, I think it was pointed out that only 2 nations in the world still followed the practice of putting to death someone convicted of capital murder committed before the person was 18. Those 2 nations were Somalia, which in fact is not an active nation, and the United States. Now, you know, was it wrong to point that out? Many said it was. But I don't think it was wrong to point that out in the opinion.
Right. You're also asking a technical question, though, which is true. There are three, your question brings together three different problems that are in front of us. One problem is almost non-controversial, oddly enough, and that is the problem of law that comes before us all the time. Say, discovery. Do you have a right to discover? Does Company A, can it discover material from Company B when they want to give it to a foreign institution like the European Anti-Cartel Authority? Or an antitrust case as a plaintiff in Ecuador? You know, there are bread and butter cases all the time where the answer to the cases requires us, really, to look to some law of other nations. And we'll do it without comment. Then there's the kind of question which is the most important politically, which Justice O'Connor talked about, and that's led to all the fuss. And that's in cases where you don't have to, should you ever go and look at some foreign law. And we both think, sure, for the reasons she gave. Then there's another kind of case which is right in front of us this year, and it's pretty interesting, and it's unusual. And that is the case where there is clearly foreign law in the form of a treaty or a rule of international law. And does that bind us? And the answer to that question is, not surprisingly, it depends. If Congress has signed a treaty binding us, as is the Warsaw Convention for airplane accidents, of course it binds us.
Or the Geneva Convention.
Right, well, yeah.
Justice O'Connor mentioned the Geneva Convention, in case you couldn't hear.
I'll save the rest of this for later, because I think.
Well, I'm afraid we're all going to have to wait for later, because our time is up. We have six wonderful presentations, and we are very much indebted to both of you for sharing your perspectives today.